This is Gregory Rasputin, spiritual advisor to Tsar Nicholas and Empress Alexandra. I was having a night on the town when jealous henchmen from royal court put a couple of bullets in my back. Fortunately, Professor Buzzkill was there to minister to me and heal my wounds. Professor Buzzkill pays no heed to my teachings, but I am stoked beyond measure that his new episode is here. Slip on a bulletproof vest and listen with me.
Welcome to Halloween Week, Buzzkillers. Of course, we couldn't go through Halloween Week without discussing the famous War of the Worlds hysteria and the main character involved in War of the Worlds hysteria, Orson Welles. Fortunately for you and fortunately for me, we have the two experts on this subject, Dr. Jefferson Pooley, who's a media and communications professor at Muhlenberg College, and Dr. Michael Sokolow, who's a professor of communication and media at the University of Maine. Thank you both for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. Sokolow, this is such an important topic for so many reasons, especially in the sort of perception of media and even nowadays, especially in 2020 with the constant refrain of fake news all the time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Can you explain the background of the Orson Welles 1938 broadcast of War of the Worlds?
Yes. Okay. So you have to realize that by 1938, radio news and broadcast journalism, as we understand it today, hadn't been settled.
Uh-huh.
So radio news flashes were pretty crazy, and the scale of a story wasn't established yet. However, 1 month before the broadcast went on in September 1938, the Munich crisis occurred, which had news flashes constantly.
Right.
And so that sort of framed and set the framing for the show itself. The show itself, it was an unsponsored program that had been given to Orson Welles because he was a great dramatist with the federal project, the New Deal federal project.
When you say the scale of the story hadn't been established, what does that mean in media analyst terms?
Oh, so CBS and NBC were still working out what they break into the network for.
Oh,
so
okay.
They might break into the network for a smaller story. Like I know they've done it for local prison riots, for instance, in the 20s and 30s, which they stopped doing in the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't really know what breaking news was the way we know it today.
Okay, and this is part of the whole phenomenon, or the phenomenon that radio is a new-ish medium. And instant communication is a newish thing. So how was the show structured?
Okay, the show was structured brilliantly. So it opened with this Raymond Raquello playing his music in the Brooklyn Hotel, which would have sounded just like a regular short show. At 7 or 8 minutes in, there's a news flash, but the brilliance of it is the news flash isn't very detailed. And then they go back to the music. And then a few minutes later of the music, they come back, they flesh it out. And over the next 15 minutes, they really make it sound like news is breaking, but they're still finding out the story.
So is this a kind of play within a play or show within a show?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's meta in that way. And interestingly, Welles would be asked later, and he didn't realize that it would work out that way. And same with the CBS executives. They believed people would believe it was a show.
People would believe it was a show. Okay. Okay. And then I think it was Welles himself who adapted the novel to the radio script.
Well,
right?
Howard Koch, the two of them.
Oh, Howard Koch.
Yeah, the
Koch.
Two of them did it. And there may have been a third or fourth writer, but yeah.
And how did they do that? What did they choose to leave in? What did they choose to leave out? How did they Americanize it, for instance?
That's a famous story that's a little bit contested, shall we say.
Good, we love those.
And Welles. Apparently, Welles was very, very busy that week. And Koch came up with two or three different ideas and ran them by him. But it was getting very close to showtime. And they were in a hotel room, and they had to have a script. And so they kind of just threw it against the – this is Welles' version. Koch said he had designed it this way. But they threw it against the wall, and you know, the day before, they figured out how they could do it. And then they went into the rehearsal that night, the following morning, and the day. So it was really done at the last kind of minute.
Yeah.
And as to adapting it to America, it seems kind of obvious to us now. I'm not sure they detailed as much, but it really was what had happened 1 month before. It was ripped from the headlines, like our TV shows today, Law and Order.
Right.
Like they had all, everybody in America had just heard these news flashes
about
Munich.
So
it kind of makes sense that they would do it about Munich.
Yeah. By the way, we should have reminded Buzzkillers early on, we have a Wells problem here. This is, of course, H.G. Wells' novel, The War of the Worlds, adapted by Orson Welles, spelled W-E-L-L-E-S, the American dramatist. But I interrupted the plot there. It's amazing that they got this together within, well, less than a week.
Well, every adaptation for that show was less than a week.
Wow.
Because I don't know if he had a Broadway show he was acting in at the time.
Oh, okay.
And he rented an ambulance with a siren to get him from the Broadway show to the radio studio. His life.
Well, that's not dramatic at all.
Well, you know, immediately after this, when he signed on to the film script, he was TWA's most frequent flyer because he was flying in 1939. He was flying Los Angeles, New York constantly to be Hollywood and radio.
Okay, well, we're going to have a link to the audio, which is free because it's out of copyright and everything, for the Buzzkillers to listen to later on. But can you sort of summarize the plot and summarize the broadcast itself?
Yeah, the plot is very simple. There's an invasion from Mars out in New Jersey, and the broadcast itself presents this as break-in radio flashes for the first half as the people are dying and as the machines get closer to New York. And the first half ends with the reporter on the roof of a building in New York City watching New Jersey get destroyed, essentially. And then the second half, which everybody forgets about, is the world is destroyed. And it's much more and it's a rumination on the end of the world. Are we allowed to do the spoiler alert or no for how the story ends?
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
So the kicker is that bacteria end up killing the Martians who invaded. And the irony of the whole thing is that the world had built these massive, gigantic weaponry to fight the Martians, and it ended up being something microscopic that was all around them that saved the Earth.
Right, right. And the second part, when the Buzzkillers listen to it, we'll see, it's very bleak and dark. I mean, it's a long rumination. It's very disheartening and makes you think about the human condition and all kinds of things. It's not surprising that it fits in so well with the late 30s.
Yeah, not just the Depression, but from my perspective, thinking about the wars coming, the Munich.
Yeah.
What happens if the world had gone to war over Munich, over the invasion of Czechoslovakia?
All right, then we know what's happened. We know it's produced. We know it's gone out there. What is the immediate aftermath?
The immediate aftermath. Now this is complicated. The immediate aftermath is telephone, incredible telephone usage. Okay,
uh-huh.
But it's not people running out on the street. It's not the mass panic that we think about. The telephone usage triggers the newspapers. The newspapers run down to CBS and they run with this story of a massive panic. But that's the immediate aftermath is the rumor of the massive panic all over New York and America.
Yeah. And then it's the newspapers that take it up. And that's why if you Google this, you can get a Google image search and you can see newspaper headlines that have this reaction. And Wells panics the world. Orson Wells panics the world, panics the country.
Yeah. It's because the story goes on through the 20th century and becomes a massive historical moment. We tend to forget just how quickly the events unfolded. The show ends at 9, and there were papers on the street by 10:30, 90 minutes later.
That's right. We used to have morning papers and evening papers. Well, our grandparents' generation did.
And, well, it's a quiet Sunday night. It's a very quiet Sunday night, and here's a chance to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so a bunch of newsrooms get pulled in. The editor, radio editor of the New York Daily News talks about his newsroom getting pulled in to make an emergency paper that night.
Oh, right. And of course, we have images of this on the website and on our social media. Well, then, Dr. Pooley, how this immediately gets analyzed by academics? How does that happen? Why is it so quick to get into that sort of vein?
It's a remarkable story, actually. Frank Stanton, who was the research director of CBS, was also a PhD psychologist and involved in a radio research project based at Princeton that was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. And he was listening, driving down Madison Avenue to the broadcast, and at the climax, realized both that it would be an incredible research opportunity, but also had some fears that the Federal Communications Commission might be interested in filing an inquiry. So he parked took the elevator up to the to his office and essentially created a questionnaire on the spot. And he called his research partner, commissioned the study, and had it out in the field the next day. And that began what was a two-year saga of contested authorship and complicated maneuverings around what then became, by 1940, a best-selling academic book called The Invasion from Mars. And I can say more about the intervening drama, but this book that got published in 1940 by an author named Hadley Cantrell helped solidify and, I think, probably legitimize the idea that there was this mass hysteria. And it then became the main source for lots of the later rememberings that were included in social psychology and mass communication textbooks and in popular remembrances too, including all the way up to the last few years when PBS and NPR, you know, broadcast major remembrances.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is amazing because we have the show being produced within less than a week. We have the immediate newspaper reaction rushing in more less than a night. And then we have this academic study being cranked up almost immediately. This seems like overreaction mania or knee-jerk reaction mania.
It's a good point. I mean, in fact, the Frank Stanton, who was to become the president of CBS, and his partners in this Princeton-based radio research effort, they were on the perch of losing the Rockefeller grant, or not having it renewed at least. And they were, as a result, pretty nervous. And they also had in mind this idea that they later referred to as firehouse research, which is the idea of taking something that happens in opportunistically jumping on it. And what's fascinating about the research that they then put into the field, which didn't just include that questionnaire that Stanton had commissioned, but also some New Jersey-based in-depth interviews, was that the research showed pretty convincingly that there wasn't a panic, first of all, and that, in fact, most of the interview data that they gathered, in addition to showing that most Americans didn't actually tune in, the sort of detailed, in-depth interviews found that many people actually did what the researchers called checking up. That is to say, they might have initially been nervous or excited, but then checked another source, like called a friend or used some other external check. And the book itself actually, as published, does indeed go into detail about all of this checking up and relates it to people's educational backgrounds and their kind of quote unquote critical ability. But the book itself is sort of framed in dramatic terms, the book that gets remembered, the one called The Invasion from Mars, so that it's really the fifth through seventh chapters that go into detail about all of this checking up. There are, you know, the appropriate qualifiers around the audience size and things like this, but the book's jacket, its back cover copy, even the sequence of chapters reinforces the idea that there was mass hysteria. So the first chapter is a reproduction of the script of the show itself. And the Princeton University Press promotional materials, including the jacket and so on, play up the hysteria. So it's ironic that the book that played such a big role in perpetuating the myth actually also contains within it a sort of way of debunking the myth. It's like the cover.
Yeah.
And I would say the author, who was this figure, Hadley Cantrell, who was debonair, extraordinarily ambitious and Machiavellian, kind of maneuvered to gain sole authorship over the book's credit, that he himself had a kind of interest in playing up the dramatic element for the purposes of his career and his own interests. And that's its own fascinating story that is worth talking about if we have time later.
So, like so many things, you would have to have read the book, first of all, in full, and have read it carefully to notice all the qualifiers and all the this is who was listening to this. But of course, 99% of people don't do that. And if the jacket has the big Martian space, the big Martian landers coming down, you know, it's easy to get fooled. So again, is this another, and also this is also fits in, you see, 1940 with the war having already now started and cranking up. It sort of feeds into, here's an academic a plank to the panic justification.
That's right. I mean, there was already in the interwar years lots of concern over propaganda from World War I and concern over advertising and radio itself. And then once you have Goebbels and the Nazis broadcasting and the concern, the popular concern, and also the academic study of propaganda mushroomed during and especially after the war. And I want to be clear that the Cantrell misreading the book, that is to say, being misread as this, I don't know, proof of or evidence that there was a big mass hysteria, this wasn't just a popular misunderstanding. In fact, you can trace the academic reception of the book so that in academic studies aimed at other scholars, but especially textbooks, right, that this was constantly cited. And all the way to today, you could still discover citations to this original 1940 book. So I don't want to give the misleading impression that it was like the newsman and the average person who were taking the desk and the book copy as a false indication. It was, in fact, the scholarship that carried the myth for the most part, with, you know, the mutual interplay then of remembrances and like the 1957 one.
Well, what are some of the things buried in the Cantrell book that people have overlooked or should have realized in the first place?
Well, I already mentioned this idea of checking up, and that the book itself gives us the evidence that people checked up. And one of the ironies is that Cantrell's book shows that people called their neighbors, which is exactly what you'd expect people to do if they were trying to verify what had initially excited them. So this was one of the reasons that the book itself contains within it the seeds of slaying the myth.
Was there any way to measure? Because one of the things I've always heard is that people would change the dial. They'd go to NBC or some of the to check up. Was there any way that Cantrell measured that, or was it only calling neighbors?
No, there wasn't any way based on the data they had. And there were a few different sources. I mentioned the Stanton data. I mentioned some in the field, in-depth interviews. There were 135 of them that this Princeton radio project gathered. And then there also were data from George Gallup and his outfit, which was actually located there in Princeton. And those surveys were conducted later, at least a week later, if I'm not mistaken. In any event, none of them was, none of the viewership, or I should say listenership data was able to detect, given the way it was gathered, whether any of the audience had changed the dial. And again, this is something that Cantrell admits in the book, that there's no way in which that claim can be verified.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes, quick? Please. Sorry, let me just remind the buzzkillers that you're Dr. Sokolow.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I found in the Frank Stanton papers at the Library of Congress, I found the most fascinating thing. Turns out that there are about 150 audimeters, A-U-D-I-M-E-T-E-R-S, that were being tested out in November 1938, 1 week after War of the Worlds, on the show through the A.C. Nielsen Company. And Stanton was given a copy of what the audimeters showed, which is a minute-by-minute listening device, okay? This is the only, this study's never been cited. It was a test of a technology in 1938.
Wow.
It was rolled out the first week of November, 1 week after the show, and they did it with Mystery Theater. They did it with which became Campbell's Playhouse, right? And what it actually discovered, and Stanton never told anybody this, and it's never been published, was that people tune out at the second commercial. Everybody thought that the most popular show, when they went to their singer, people tuned from NBC to CBS. It was the Charlie McCarthy show.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the audimeter showed that people stayed through the first half of the comedy variety show, and the huge turning of the dial occurs in the second commercial, you know, with about 5 minutes left when the plot is wrapped up and they bring the singer out the second time, and you know the show's going to end. There's a huge drop off in dial turn. So, in fact, the one study, and it's a teeny study, I think it was like 140 audimeters. The one study we have shows that the dial twisting, and this is true to today, essentially, dial twisting really happens at the end of a show. It's very rare it happens at the start.
Is there any way to, but there was no way to determine, because of this in theory, special case that sounded, I'm putting this in air quotes, buzzkillers, like news, people dialed switched earlier than they normally would?
No, Jeff's correct on that. There's no data. There's no published data.
Okay, well, this is a very good time for us to take a break. But before we do, I'd like to have a shout out to New Jersey buzzkillers, because it's I think maybe perhaps here's a conspiracy theory. It's more than coincidental that the studies come out of Princeton, because after all, in the radio play, the big landing of the Martians that's being reported is from Plainfield, New Jersey. Is that what it is? In the show itself?
Something Mill.
Grover's Mill or something. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So sort of central New Jersey is getting this big boost of attention through this fantastic part of American culture and history. Okay, we're going to take a little ad break and then we'll be back in a moment, buzzkillers. We have a station ID break, and on the line is Diane from Milwaukee.
Hi, Professor. I'm calling in on behalf of the Cage Free Vegan Society.
Wait, what? They don't put vegans in cages.
They do in Wisconsin, Professor. This is dairy country.
Okay. You can mention the Cage Free Vegan Society.
But that's not what I want to talk about.
Okay.
Buzzkillers and other listeners should go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and click on support the show. For as little as $1 a month, listeners can join Buzzkill Society.
Okay, what are the benefits of being a member of the Buzzkill Social Order?
Members of Buzzkill Society get shout outs on the show, chances to win free copies of books, and lots of other goodies like coffee cups and t-shirts at higher levels. Most importantly, they get the immense satisfaction of knowing that they're keeping the Buzzkill social fabric together.
Oh, what's the website again?
ProfessorBuzzkill.com. That's ProfessorBuzzkill.com.
Thanks, Diane. Anything else you want to tell the Buzzkillers?
Yes, free Gwyneth Paltrow.
You're a weirdo, Diane.
Takes one to know one.
We're back, Buzzkillers, with Dr. Jefferson Pooley from Muhlenberg College and Dr. Michael Sokolow from the University of Maine, talking about the famous 1938 War of the Worlds radio program and the supposed panic that it created. Now, when we left, professors, you were talking about mainly the academic studies and the most important one from Hadley Cantrell, who analyzed this myth and in his analysis in many ways gets misunderstood. Can you tell us a little bit more, Dr. Pooley, about what happens in his career? Because if this is a big deal in 1940, the United States goes into the war, is he then doing other social studies in this way?
Yeah, well, I might say he could be read as willfully being misread, and in the sense that this book turns out to be crucial to his career. And just to rewind a tiny bit, I referred to a kind of struggle over authorship of the book itself. And it turns out that Stanton, Cantrell, and a third figure, this Paul Lazarsfeld, an Austrian emigre of Jewish origin, were the three of them directing this radio research project in Princeton. Mm-hmm. And all three of them were involved one way or another in this study, and a couple of female researchers who've been forgotten to posterity, Herta Herzog and Hazel Godet, were instrumental in doing the research. And I mentioned them in part because, though they did get a kind of assistance of credit on the eventual published book, the norms of the time around female research credit and some of the specific factors of Cantrell's ambition and zeal to gain sole authorship meant that their contributions to the book and the initial framing of the research are forgotten almost entirely.
Yeah.
Herta Herzog happens to be Paul Lazarsfeld, this figure I mentioned, second wife. Without going into too much detail, what was at stake at this moment, 1938, 1939, was the Rockefeller Foundation's funding for this research project. Cantrell had a stake in it, and Lazarsfeld had a stake in it. Stanton was ensconced at CBS. I mention this because Lazarsfeld and Cantrell had a big struggle over a number of issues, which resulted partly as a kind of compromise in them parting their ways. And Cantrell, partly on the strength of this book, was able to secure a second Rockefeller grant that established a public opinion research office partnered with George Gallup, who I mentioned earlier, and deeply partnered itself with the Roosevelt administration during World War II, and providing detailed public opinion survey data from around the world related to the war. And this put Cantrell, who was a savvy operator, very polished in the media, very, very skilled at planting stories, in the public spotlight. He benefited and was catapulted, you might say, by the publicity and bestsellerdom of the Invasion from Mars book, and leveraged that at just this moment when he had a new infusion of Rockefeller money, partnered with it, the Gallup operation, to gain a spotlight in the public opinion polling that was itself also informing the war policy, as it turns out.
Mm-hmm.
And these were mutually reinforcing. Cantrell's reputation boosted from the sales of the book and the public opinion polling he did in World War II and afterwards, and in combination helped spread the myth in the early post-war years.
And of course, public opinion polling, although not brand new, is still in developmental stages.
That's right. It's Cantrell, who's one of the handful of academics who hit on public opinion polling as an academic field, but it really doesn't take its modern form until 1936, just before this period, when Gallup himself, develops the idea of using sampling.
Right.
And so, yes, this is absolutely early in the history of both the popular and academic use of opinion polling.
Well, then what happens, Professor Sokolow, after the war, after Cantrell's done his war work and done his work on public opinion in that regard? How does this panic from 1938, and again, panic in air quotes, become legend after the war in the 1950s, et cetera?
Well, Cantrell becomes pretty famous as a propaganda genius. Mm-hmm. You know, he started with figuring out War of the Worlds and the mass panic. And then in World War II, he's in the newspapers as somebody who's really, who understands crowds. And then, as Jeff said, right after World War II, there's this big growth in, remember Dewey defeats Truman,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
There's this big growth in public opinion polling and elections. And so Cantrell becomes almost a father figure. He had been working on this stuff 10 years before anybody else in 1938. So by 1948, when public opinion polls are everywhere, he's looked to for expert quotes in the paper. And everybody remembers him as the Invasion from Mars guy. Everybody remembers him as the guy who figured out how to measure a panic. I mean, think of first guy ever to figure out how to measure a panic. That's a huge academic star kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so by the early 50s, when you have things like the Red Scare and people trying to figure out what's happening in politics and with communism and things like that, public opinion polling grows tremendously. And he's kind of a father figure of the field, which helps ratify the myth.
Right, right, right. Well, then how does this percolate through to other media? As I see from my Buzzkill notes that there's a show in the late 50s called The Night America Trembled. There's a show in 1975 called The Night America Panicked, The Night That Panicked America, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems like people don't want to let go of this.
Well, look at when it happens. Why is it happening 20 years later and 40 years later?
Yeah, yeah.
The media is very nostalgic. Right? So by 1957, those people back in 1938, our parents back in 1938, remember Happy Days?
Yeah.
And remember how in the 1970s, TV shows were all about the 1950s?
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a very common trope in the mass media. And so part of it is look at that. Look at how they couldn't handle it. It's the entertainment value of it. Look at how they couldn't handle this new media.
Oh, I see.
That's a theory, by the way. I don't know, Jeff, that's from the entertainment side. Jeff probably knows better from the intellectual side, but I have nothing to prove that theory.
No, well, it's also true that I would just add to that as a supplement that CBS broadcast that first 1957 airing,
this is CBS Radio 1957, The Night America Trembled.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
And again, just like Michael said, it's sort of speculative, but the networks have an interest in demonstrating to advertisers that they have influence and effects, and so you can at least imagine how CBS would be interested in demonstrating in this vivid and electrifying past instance of the medium's massive influence, indeed its own broadcast.
Yeah. So it's a way of saying, look what we can do. We're sorry that it happened this way, but we have this other influence.
What one thing I just want to point out that's sort of funny, that CBS aired the show CBS both aired the original Panic show and then aired the show looking back at the Panic, is if the FCC had really thought there was a national panic that caused a tremendous problem, CBS wouldn't have celebrated it with a dramatic show, right?
Okay.
Or if they had to pay a huge fine and respond to the government, and if legislation had passed, none of this happened. The FCC didn't fine them.
Yeah.
There was no legislation passed. But there wouldn't be a celebratory show about it on the same network.
That brings up an interesting point. We should remind the Buzzkillers that the government doesn't crack down in 1938 on CBS or anybody else. That Wells isn't thrown in jail. There isn't a congressional investigation or anything like that.
In fact, it's exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite. The FCC issues a proclamation about a month later saying that nobody challenging a broadcast license can use War of the Worlds against the licensee that aired it.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing.
So they protect, they do the opposite. Rather than go after CBS, they protect every CBS licensee from getting challenged on airing phony news.
And of course, there are zillions of radio stations, local CBS radio stations across the country. So this, someone with an axe to grind about something else might use that against their local CBS station to say, oh, by the way, I don't like how you treated this presidential candidate, and here's proof that you've do fake news all the time. Well, later on in 1975, and I remember this TV movie, I remember it being kind of crappy, but it was called The Night That Panicked America on a competing network, ABC Television. What was that? Again, is this part of the 20-year generational nostalgia thing?
I think it's the same thing. I think it's nostalgia for an easier time when the media was when the media was simpler.
Yeah.
I think there's something else going on here, which is we like to think audiences in the past were a lot stupider than us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think we like to believe that about our grandparents in the Nickelodeon.
Right. Right.
We believe that the train was running right at them, so they dove out of the way. Or people listening to radio in 1938. For some reason, and I don't know, I don't know the reason for it. Okay. So I'm not even going to guess. But for some reason, we like to think audiences in the past were stupider than us, had less critical ability to assess what they were consuming than we do today. I'm not 100% convinced of that.
And I will just jump in there and say that it's a very well-established finding in media research that people generally assume others, their contemporaries, not to even get to the audiences of the past, are more affected by media than they themselves are. It's referred to as the third person effect. The third person effect. And the way in which this could apply to the past, even in a more dramatic way, is obvious. And Michael and I wrote about how, in particular, African Americans were the object of ridicule in lots of the newspaper reporting the next day or the day after from the original broadcast, that reports were filed from Harlem that were kind of playing on and almost just directly lifting Amos and Andy style minstrelsy and for comedic effect about kind of easily spooked African Americans running out into the streets. So even at the time, there was this stratified way in which audiences of different types, women included, were singled out for their hysteria, operating in kind of the way that Michael's talking about.
Well, that brings us up to which is 40 years later, the two other sort of legendary, two other things that add to the legend. In 2013, PBS did an American Experience show. And in 2018, NPR did a Radio Lab show about this. And in both instances, despite all of your research and Joseph Campbell's research, which we'll get to in a moment, I was very disappointed that both of these shows sort of sidelined the actual myth-busting and went with the panic. Dr. Pooley, how does that, why does that come up in the mid-20-teens, and why does it still mainly follow this sort of dominant narrative, as we like to say in academia?
Well, it's a good question. So PBS was clearly hitching this to the 75th anniversary in 2013. Uh-huh. So the American Experience documentary you're referring to was timed that way for that reason. But they knew the more complicated story. The producers had reached out to Michael and others. They certainly were aware the academics were had already punctured the myth. And I will just add as an aside, the research that's been conducted since 2013 has put the nail in the coffin. And I refer to colleagues like Brad Schwartz and others who've done research to further cement what was already, however, knowable in 2013 and directly supplied to the producers of that PBS show. So it just brings the question that you asked originally back to the fore. Why did they nevertheless narrate the story in that hysterical way? And I guess I would just return to the fact that it's an excellent story, that it is well implotted. It has all of the thrilling pieces of dramatic narrative that would appeal. It's almost irresistible in a way, because it's got the the kind of Schadenfreude from a past audience element that Michael was raising a few minutes ago, and it does have this impressive technical precision from Orson Welles himself in the genius production that survives in audio form. So there's the good media to go with it. All of these contribute, I think, to what makes it very, very difficult for a documentary producer, or for that matter, an introduction to sociology teacher, to resist the temptation to retell a great story.
Right.
And also, I would just add a real quick thing here. A lot of people think if you say there was no panic, you're casting aspersion on Orson Welles, the radio artist. Absolutely not. I think I can speak for Jeff when I say this is one of the most brilliant pieces of radio drama that was ever constructed anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. There's no question. This was an absolutely brilliant piece of radio drama. Whether it created the panic or not shouldn't matter to that. We can evaluate it as a brilliant piece of theater.
Right. In fact, with the fact that the panic and the panic myth sort of overwhelms any study of whether it was good drama or not. But, you know, one of the... When NPR's Radiolab came out with a show on this in 2018, and of course it has a podcast element to it, I thought, well, I won't have to do a show on this because they're going to take care of it. But then again, I was tremendously disappointed that they didn't do what we're doing here today. And I'm sorry, Radiolab, to call you out on this, and you can blast me at hatemail@professorbuzzkill.com. But, you know, as relatively recently as that, it's still... It's such a big elephant in the room, such a big rock in the lake, that people go with that for 85% of the show. Then they add this little addendum at the end saying, oh, by the way, it's been exaggerated.
Well, it's great. I will say this. The myth is our work. And as Jeff mentioned, people like Brad Schwartz and others, the tide is turning. Like we're cited on the Snopes page. There's a Snopes page.
Right,
now.
Right.
So if you enter the question, was there a panic in War of the Worlds? I'm sure the first two or three hits the day are revisionists. They are not. Actually, I'm not sure.
That's good. Oh, wait a minute. I could do that right now.
The interesting thing is you'd have to check your algorithm, right? Yeah. If the algorithm thinks you want to see a panic, they'll give you Cantrill. If the algorithm thinks you don't want to see a panic, they'll give you Cooley and Sokolo.
Was there a War of the Worlds? Yes, but not Snopes. Yeah, Snopes is number four. Something from NPR said there was started a panic or did it. You know, and of course the Wikipedia page comes up first, but Slate had a thing on it. So yeah, you're right. The first few Google entries or whatever you want to call them, hits, do sort of say nowadays that there has been a reevaluation of this. But still, the myth is very alluring. I mean, despite what we've just Googled and what we've just talked about, I think most people still believe it. And certainly I know a lot of students who are even 18, 19 years old nowadays are taught it in sociology courses.
Yeah, I will just say that one aspect could be that if you take it as a kind of wet cement moment, that the myth solidified by the early 1940s, that you had the newspaper coverage immediately, and it was driven, as Michael already talked about, by selling newspapers and the sensationalism, but also by a kind of cross-medium rivalry with radio. And so you had the newspaper element, you had this academic book that fit the narrative too, and more than that, even furnished legitimacy. And by then, the cement hardened. There's like almost like a threshold of storytelling that gave it this, to use an anachronistic metaphor, an Energizer Bunny character, where it just kept going. The story had been formed, and it becomes very difficult, even if your YouTube and Google searching will provide counter evidence, it becomes very difficult to dislodge something that is underway.
Yeah, it's like a tank. Like, once it starts, it's hard to stop.
And also, the story makes sense because it confirms our bias. So in other words, if you think about today, the way the left loves to talk about, both the left and the right on Facebook and in social media, loves to point out that these other people are being fooled by fake news. Really doesn't matter where you are in the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. You're sure somebody else is being fooled by fake news.
Yeah.
That's the kind of confirmation bias it plays off of. So we enjoy that confirmation bias.
If there are these fact checkers, and we had a show a couple of weeks ago on the famous quote, a lie travels halfway around the world before the truth is getting its shoes on. If the truth has had its shoes on now in this instance for 40 or years or so, and is only now starting to pop up on Google searches at the very top, are there, and presumably we hope that it would decline in the near future, what are the implications of that decline? Does it tell us anything more about broader media studies or broader media understanding of the media?
Okay. I would say the implications of the correction of the War of the Worlds myth holds tremendous promise or portent for so many famous social psychology studies that we've been through. So for instance, I'll give you one example. You may have heard of something called the bystander effect.
Yes.
The Kitty Genovese story.
Yeah.
Okay. We have since found out, and this is not really debatable because the person who wrote the article, A.M. Rosenthal at the New York Times, the person who actually wrote the very first articles on Kitty Genovese, has said he was wrong.
Yeah.
So it's not really debatable. There's an entire field of social psychology that went into testing bystander effect experimentally and empirically, try and ratify it. And here we have a case of journalism really twisting what we're trying to do in terms of gaining scientific knowledge. And so there's a series of studies now, the Stanford Prison Experiment, mm-hmm. The bystander effect, several that are seemingly being rethought and rechecked. And it's causing kind of a replication crisis. But on the other hand, I think it's very healthy because this is how science works.
Right, right. People go back over and retest and try to verify.
I agree that it's heartening that the myth has been partly dislodged. I suspect, however, that it will continue to march along and to some extent. And my only asterisk to Michael's point about all of this, you know, justified skepticism about major social psychological findings is that we might inadvertently contribute to a climate of skepticism, a kind of post-truth culture of questioning everything, a sort of doubt mm-hmm. culture. Ultimately, that kind of worry can't overcome the fact that in this case, we have evidence that is overwhelming, showing that this hysteria didn't happen in the way that it's portrayed.
Right. Well, we don't want doubt culture to creep into people's perceptions of Professor Buzzkill, because after all, we almost always interview the absolute top experts in the various fields that we study. So it just remains for me to say thank you to Dr. Pooley and thank you to Dr. Sokolow for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And Buzzkillers, we will talk to all of you next week.